show about swim, bike and run, and much, much more in the wild and wacky world of sport. The show is brought to you by Australian Broadcasting Media for Radio Sydney FM, and we're also available on iTunes. I'm Rupert Guinness, your solo host for this week. Aaron is still over in the United States, heading towards Virginia and then towards Richmond, where the World Road Race Cycling Championships will be held in the last week of September. But we'll be touching in with Aaron a little bit later on in the show because he's been immersing himself in the world of BMX. And he's going to be having a chat to one of their young and up-and-coming stars in the world of BMX, who you never know, we could be hearing about in years to come. And why not on the road? A lot of our famous, or most successful road racers began their careers in BMX. Anyway, that's for later. As I said, we've got a heap on for this episode, episode 8 of What a Ride. Some of the people we're going to talk to in this episode are John Trevorrow, who's one of the foremost personalities, I would say, of Australian cycling. Not for his history as a cyclist, which was very impressive. He won the Herald Sun Tour of Victoria 3 times in his career. He also raced in Europe. But now he's one of the foremost race directors in Australian cycling. He's also a very well-known commentator of the sport, and he's certainly a very, very colourful character. His nickname is Iffy. We'll let you sort of figure that out until we get back to hear from him. We're also going to be chatting with one of my erstwhile colleagues at Fairfax Media, Daniel Lane. He's a sports journalist who's been around the traps for a fair amount of time, and we've sort of often engaged in some good discussions in the office there and talked about a lot of different sports because we both follow a lot of different sports. He actually caught up with the former 2 times ITU World Triathlon champion, Michele Jones, who's over in the United States. He's written a fabulous piece for the Sun Herald, and we speak to Dan about some insights from Michele, what she's up to in the United States, and also we talk about the Sydney 2000 Olympics, where she won the silver medal. And we sort of went down memory lane a little bit there as the sun was setting over Sydney Harbour as we chatted. So Dan's got some great insights, and we also talk a little bit about boxing, some cricket, and he reveals as to who his favourite cyclist is. Further in the show, as I said, we'll catch up with Aaron. We're also going to chat with Phil Anderson. Now, we spoke to him in the last show, but this time we don't talk about bike racing so much. We talk about cycling tourism. The market is expanding as the sport's expanding. And Phil has his own company, and he talks about some of the ins and outs of the pros and cons of running a business. It can be like herding cats, I'd imagine, out there with so many people out in the roads of the Tour de France and other big races where these tours go to. But Phil also talks about the industry in general, which happens to be, I think, one of the boom industries within cycling, and how different touring companies tailor their tours to suit specific needs. Some, companies like to go for backpacker-type markets. Some like to go for the 5-star deluxe, haute cuisine, fine wine, with a little bit of pedaling in between. It's everybody's, flavour is met there, and so certainly that'll be an interesting chat. But as I said, it's been a busy period of sport at the moment, certainly here in Australia. We're getting right into the thick of footy's final season in both the AFL, Australian football, and the NRL, National Rugby League. Meanwhile, in the world of rugby union, one of the rounds that I do cover for the Sydney Morning Herald, all eyes are heading towards the United Kingdom for the Rugby World Cup. Now, Australia's national team, the Wallabies, they're taking a long road there. They're heading there towards all through the United States, where they've just finished a 2-week spell of training, including a one-off test against the US Eagles, which the Wallabies won 47-10. Now, as you remember, a couple of episodes ago, we spoke to the Wallabies captain, Stephen Moore, about the campaign, their hopes, their not concerns, but the areas or the challenges that they'll face. And I remember Stevie Moore actually recalled how he was able to draw on the way that cyclists ride, particularly Richie Porte. He used as an example how Richie Porte had a huge role in saving Chris Froome in winning the Tour de France on that last mountain stage up to the top of Alpe d'Huez. So, we wish the Wallabies all the very best there in the United Kingdom. I know I've been speaking to some of their players in the days since they've been in the US, and it sounds like their coach, local Coogee resident, Michael Checker, has been absolutely flogging them as well. So one thing is certain, I'd say, is they're going to be very, very fit. Anyway, so elsewhere in the world of sport, All Australia has been following the famous, or not famous, the fantastic story of Jared Hayne, the former NRL rugby league player from the Parramatta Eels, who has secured his contract, or he got onto the final 53-strong player list for the San Francisco 49ers in the NFL. Now, as soon as that happened, all the attention was then on whether he would actually get to play for the 49ers in their NFL opening round against the Vikings. But whether he makes that, whether he was going to make that or not, you know, the achievement he's already done is absolutely fantastic. The to not just code switch, but just to actually almost change sports. So much has been written about him. So much still will be written about him. So much will be said. So much will be heard. But whatever happens from here on in, I think the achievement he's done, he's made already, is absolutely phenomenal. It was interesting to hear just with a day or two out from hearing whether he would make that first game or not. He was just starting to get fed up a bit with all the attention, though. You can imagine that, can't you? He's trying to earn the respect of his teammates. He's certainly done that on the field, but the last thing he wants is to be seen as a headline grabber. And he's certainly not grabbing the headlines, but just the natural interest of his story has attracted so much media attention, and not just from Australia too. He has been the pre-season story of the NFL. We've spoken to Aaron about that since he's been over there in the US, and you know, Aaron's spoken very highly about how Jared Hayne has managed to handle all this on the field and off the field. But anyway, rest assured, I'd say Jared Hayne is a name we're going to keep on hearing about for the rest of the year and maybe many more years to come. Now, as I said, we've got a great show lined up for this week. You know, when we spoke to John Trevorrow, we started off, or the intent was just to talk about road cycling in Europe, because obviously we've got the Vuelta a España has just approached its end, its final stages, and the Orica Green Edge team has done superbly well there, extremely well, in fact. But when we spoke to John Trevorrow, we also spoke to him just a little bit, or literally an hour, before the Amy's Criterium and the Amy's Road Race, which was the day after, which is an NRS women's race named after Amy Gillette, who was tragically killed in 2005 when she was in Germany with the Australian team. But as tragic as her death was, one good thing that was created from it was the Amy Gillette Foundation, which was all about road safety, creating awareness of cyclists and drivers looking after each other, keeping an eye out for each other, under the motto of A Metre Matters. And certainly that campaign, or that initiative, is now an organisation, has made great inroads into road safety awareness, even though it is still a problem. We can never be complacent. But anyway, John Trevorrow is organised, the race director of that two-day event, which was held down in Lawn in Victoria, and also on the second day was the Amy Gillette Grand Fondo for all the cyclo-tourists who want to get out there and ride. So it's a fantastic initiative. So we spoke to John, we caught up with him, we spoke to him about what he was doing down there in Lawn, and also we spoke a bit about, or quite a lot about, the Vuelta a España, and also some more about the World Road Race Championships, which Aaron will be at later on. In any case, let's just have a listen to see what John had to say.
Well, I'm talking now with one of Australian cycling's most well-known personalities. He's a three times winner of the Sun Tour of Victoria, or now the Herald Sun Tour of Victoria, I should say. He's also one of Australia's most prominent race directors, and he's a very well-known cycling commentator. His name is John Trevorrow. I've got him on the line now. He's down in Lawn in Victoria, where he's the race director for the Amy's Criterium and the Amy's road race on the next day. And there's also, at the same time, the Amy Gillette Grand Fondo, named obviously after Amy Gillette, who tragically was killed a number of years ago in Germany in 2005 in a training accident with the Australian team. But John Trevorrow, welcome to What a Ride.
G'day, Rupert. Thanks for having me on, mate.
Yeah, look, it's it sounds like it's all happening there. I know someone's just delivered you a hamburger. I guess it's with one of the perks of the job of being race director. You get to have someone get you all your food, your domestique, so to speak.
I'm sitting in a little cafe overlooking the course, which is all closed off, and on beautiful lawn on the Great Ocean Road. There's a huge crowd, because there's 5,000 doing Amy's Grand Fondo tomorrow, and they've all got to come in today to sign on, so, you know, they're all here to watch the race, which starts in an hour's time.
Gee, so we've got you at a very special moment when, for a race director, this could be like the time you should be in your locker room, so to speak, preparing for the big event.
Oh, a race director of a crit's pretty easy. The commissaires have to do all the rule side of things, and it's fairly safe with the race closed. But look, it is a wonderful event, and you and I both remember that tragic day when we heard the news that Amy was killed in Germany, because we were on the tour, we weren't that far away from where it happened, actually. And so it sort of rocks the whole world, and it's wonderful that something positive has been able to come out of that terrible tragedy. You know, the Amy Gillett Foundation, what they're doing, and awareness of road safety for cyclists and motorists, and better cohabitate on the road, has been fantastic. And this is a wonderful event.
Yeah, like you've seen the event grow to where it is now, and also the Amy Gillett Foundation, sort of develop as to where it is now. I mean, nothing will ever bring back Amy, we all know that, obviously, but it's really is a fantastic initiative that so many people have got on board, and probably more importantly, I think the message is getting out there that a meter matters.
Yeah, very true, mate. You and I both ride a bike, although not very occasionally for me, and maybe a little bit more for you, but getting that message across is pretty important.
Now, tell me, with the racing that we're expecting, I mean, the criterium, it's a hard-fought race and also the road race. It's part of the National Road Series in Australia, and can you explain a little bit about how that's developing, the road series itself, and where how it can develop, and the importance of this event in the scheme of that?
Well, yeah, the National Road Series, there's points for all the different races, and there's been more and more women's racing coming on. I can actually see this race growing to an international race. To be able to race on this course, which is just spectacular, with fully closed roads, you don't get that very often. So I can see this growing to an international race. But, we've got, there's 56 ladies staying today in the grid. And what they've done to make it interesting, they've put, there's four sprints, all with time bonuses, 15 seconds down. So, and then 30 seconds for the win in the crit. So it really makes it pretty serious. They can't just sit back and wait for the hard stage tomorrow. They've got to all get in amongst it, try and get some time bonuses. But over the whole season, all the major races have points to add up, and someone will try and to win the overall NRS champion. And also, it's important for the teams to become the number one team in the NRS. And of course, it's a separate women's and men's series. But it's really the breeding ground for the youngsters who want to try and make it in the big time and get over to Europe, so they get themselves noticed on the NRS series, and hopefully get into the major teams.
Now, John, with your experience in racing, I mean, we should tell our audience that you did race over in Europe yourself. You did race in the Giro d'Italia. You know what's required of a rider to make it in the big in the big arena of racing in Europe. I mean, do you see talent immediately in the NRS that you say to yourself, gee, this person, you know, really does have it to become a European based road racer?
Look, I do. I don't see many of the NRS ladies racers, and unless they're connected with the guys, and this is my first time as race director, I'm an NRS ladies race. I'll probably be able to tell you a lot more after tomorrow. But I know that in the guys, the standard racing has just been quite spectacular. I was race director through Tasmania and through Gippsland and Melbourne Waterloo last year. I was so impressed with the standard and the quality of the guys, and some of those now getting pro contracts. Didn't we just have to see the guys like Richie Porsche come through, Nathan Haas, Stuart von Hoff, just wonderful guys who get that opportunity to show the stuff, and now they're racing in the pro tour. With the ladies, I reckon they've even got a better opportunity, because I've known, because the depth's not quite as high, even overseas, that the chance, if you've got that ability, you can get, come across from being just starting to making it to the top level within a year or so. It takes much longer to do that with the guys. So wonderful opportunities for women to step up from beginning to NRS and then to Pro Tour.
And do you sense that there is that willing amongst the women's peloton to seize that opportunity?
More and more so. The Bay Fighting Classic, which is my event, which I've done for 29 years, the women's race in that has become a better and better event. And now I get people coming along and saying, they're coming to watch the women's race, just how good the racing is. So it used to be people complained about the women's racing might have been a bit negative a few years back, but that's certainly changed, and we're getting fantastic racing.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we have mentioned about the big league in Europe, and notwithstanding the importance of the American circuit as well, but I guess right now, you know, the Vuelta a España, as we're talking, is drawing to its end, but there's still some big stages to come. I mean, we should declare that one of your other many hats is as a very close associate with the Orica Green Edge team, but with that comes some insights that I'm sure you can provide us with, because for Orica Green Edge, it's been a fantastic race, but they seem to have a knack of enjoying their racing, which seems to be a trait of yours.
Maybe that's why Jerry got me on board. Well, I do have an official title with Orica Green Edge. I'm the team mascot. So I don't know whether that's a good thing or not. But
mascots are usually little fluffy, cuddly toys.
Yeah, well, they haven't put me in an outfit yet. And when I got the job, I was about 35 kilos heavier than I am now. So maybe I'll get sacked from that job as well. But look, all jokes aside, you're right. They do have a special attitude in that scene. And I heard a lot of pros talking amongst each other say, if they had a choice to ride for any team, it would be Orica Green Edge because of that wonderful ambience and attitude that the team has. But I was very impressed with them on the Tour de France this year, because when all the drama happened, they were only 3 days into the race and they lost three, virtually four their best four riders, and it really meant that all chances of winning stages that were gone, and yet they never dropped their head. The attitude still stayed positive. They said, well, for last week the eight boys will step up, which they did. But the talk about the guys and everyone in the team, the masseurs and the Swannies, the managers, was still positive and it was very impressive. And gee, haven't they done well in this Vuelta? I mean, it's been a brilliant bike race. One of the best I've seen in a while. And it's one you want to watch every night, even if it is too late.
Yes.
But to win three stages, Chavez has just been what a revelation. And he looks like he's going to finish top 10, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, I had the privilege to do a lengthy interview with him during the Giro d'Italia, and the personality of Esteban just came out, as well as obviously his story as to how he managed to get his contract with the team. And it was a credit to Orica Green Edge that they still signed him up when he was on the comeback from a very serious accident that could have very well meant the end of his career. And even when he did sign, there's still no certainty that his career would actually be able to continue.
No, that's right. They did take a risk there. They believed in him. And it's funny how people forgot how good he was, because as you well know, Rick, he won 2:11 there, and he was going to be the next big Colombian. And then when he had that terrible accident and his shoulder had to be completely reconstructed, everyone forgot about him. So, and he had opportunities. They signed him up, but they've just re-signed him to 2018, which there was people prepared to pay a lot more money, and he wanted to stay with Orica Green Edge, which is pretty special.
Yeah, and it's great news that they've just re-signed him as well, I hear.
Yeah, until 2018, which is really special. Yeah.
I think it shows how that team really is backing up on its commitment at the very beginning, even when there were doubters, I'll tell you, including myself, that they were not, at the beginning, people thought, why weren't they trying to get GC riders? But they've always said, we want to get a GC rider when we're ready, when we've got the support riders and staff to be able to look after that rider. And then they've just started to develop within, rather than go and chase with the big money somebody who'd bring in it, and then they'd have to change the whole organisation around them.
Yeah, look, I think they've done it right too, because they've been pinch hitters. They've hit fought above their weight all the time, and it's been, you know, they've just had no hero, you know, got them through on the early days. But they've got good riders who just keep coming through and keep them, you know, in the news. So now they've got these with the Yates brothers and with the Chavez. And a couple of interesting signings that could be happening in the next few days, which could be even better for the GC future of the team.
Yeah, exactly. And we won't hold you up too much longer. I know you've got some big things happening, but I guess we've got to mention Caleb.
Well, only this burger, mate. It's getting cold.
Yeah, well, that's the most important. See, I'm glad to hear your priorities haven't changed in life, mate. Now, I've got to ask you, obviously, Caleb Ewan, who it was part of his program not to finish the Vuelta, but obviously he had some great racing there, and, you know, he started very well with his stage win very early, and that would have given him a lot of confidence at the back end of a year, which has been pretty challenging but successful for him.
Yes, look, you know, well, he's a superstar, but he's only a kid, you know, he's just 21, and they were really not sure whether they'd even bring him into the World Cup, because they knew he'd only be in for the first week, but didn't know whether he was quite ready. But hey, he proved that he was, because he won a stage. But even then, we know how good he's going to be.
Mm, yeah.
But it's all about management. And, you know, it's going to be, you know, people think, well, he's done this now, he'll be in the Tour de France next year. I don't think he's ready for that yet. I think it'll be a couple of years before he's ready to step up, because if he's managed and handled right, you know, he could be potential green jersey winner, you know, stage winner. You know, it's not a classic. So I don't think he could win at some stage down the track. But it might be 2-3 years before those sort of things start to happen.
Yes, yes. Now, just looking a little bit further ahead, we've got the World Championships coming up in Richmond, Virginia, US of A. Obviously, the Australian team's got a very strong selection there, and it's good to see that Simon Gerrans, touched wood, as we're speaking, he's still on his bike, even though he's had another crash in this Vuelta, but he's getting there. Do you expect big things from Gero in Richmond?
I do. Look, I know he's still ruined that opportunity of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the year before that, when he crashed before the World. So it's been a really wants to win. And that second crash in the World Cup knocked him around. His face landed. But he's coming good. So the interesting thing for them to handle is that Michael Matthews is going so well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure the two of them will be the protected riders, but that doesn't always work, as we well know. So that, how they manage that and handle that's going to be one of the big challenges for them, because they're both big chances to win.
Yeah, yeah. And just out of, I mean, we don't want to talk just about Orica Greenedge. I mean, at the Vuelta, we've, you know, there are other Australians. You know, Rory Sutherland's there doing a good job for Movistar, where we've got Quintana and Valverde racing well, and also Adam Hansen's continuing his reign of glory in getting that record of consecutive Grand Tours up.
What's he up to, 13 or something?
13,000, I think, now.
Yeah, he is an amazing story, and he's such an enigma. No one really knows a lot about him. I've heard with some of the guys who race, you know, in the peloton with him, and ask about him, and I said, well, we don't know a lot. He's friendly enough, but we don't know much about him. He's sort of, he's got all this cloak of secrecy about him, because he's got his own businesses, and he sits up at night and plays on a computer and makes more money than he does racing the bike. So he's an interesting character, but they don't come any tougher. And, you know, he came from the mountain bikes and more recreational mountain bike than anything else, and just by accident got picked up by a pro team.
Oh, well, it's a fabulous story. It's great. That's what cycling's about, isn't it? This patchwork of personalities and backgrounds of everybody's story, whether it's women's racing, men's racing, juniors, elite, veterans, you name it. It's a whole mixture of great yarns and stories, isn't it?
Yes, I've got quite a few of them.
Yeah, I think you take 99% of them, so we leave 1% for the rest of us.
As I am, you know, when you're as old as I am, you're not clear. But I love, you know, relating and retelling some of the stories from the old stars, you know. Like Reed, I was only a kid when I met him, and sort of a bit of a connection. And I remember you know, being at functions with Oppie and listening to him telling his story. So, and my dad raced as a pro, so I've got great stories from the 30s and 40s as well. So, yeah, it's a pretty special family, and it's wonderful to tell those stories.
Oh, well, look, you're a large part of it, and you've contributed so much to it. John Frivoro, you are a great person for the sport, and thanks for joining us on What a Ride, and hopefully you'll come back with us again.
Love to, Rup. Look forward to catching up, mate.
Okay, thanks very much, mate.
Episode. Well, you've just had a listen to what John Trevorrow, the race director of the Amy Gillette Grand Fondo and Amy's race, the NRS race, a two-day race, had to say about what he's doing down there. And some great insights there, I thought, from the Vuelta a España, because he does have an insider's knowledge of the Orica Green Edge team. You know, the owner of the team, Jerry Ryan, the Melbourne businessman, you know, went to John Trevorrow. He was one of the first people that he went to for advice on how to get the team going, and John's got some great connections. One of the other things we didn't say before was how John was had a pivotal role in the in Geelong in Victoria hosting the 2010 World Road Race Championships. He actually designed the course, and it was a fabulous course, a fabulous race. So John does know his stuff, but one thing he actually didn't reveal in that interview was why he's called Iffy. Okay, I should have asked him, but I'm going to give my version of events now. In his day as a racer, he, as I said, he was a fabulous racer. And he was also a personality. He still very much is. But many of his races he would finish and he'd be always saying, oh, if I could have done this, if I had have done this, I had it. Anyway, lo and behold, he became known as Iffy. And he still is today, but he is a champion fellow just as much as he was a champion cyclist. He won those three Herald Sun Tours superbly, you know, and there was a day when, cycling wasn't as predominant as it is now, but it was still very much hotly contested then, and that race has been, it's lasted so long now, more than 50 years, so it's certainly a hallmark victory for any cyclist to have on their palmarès or their list of career results. But we're going to be, as I said, we spoke about the World Championship, Simon Gerrans and Michael Matthews. You know, he's had a great year as well. He's been racing over in the US in preparation for the Worlds. Gerrans, you know, he's been racing, he raced in the Vuelta, and he had another crash. He's had, I think, up to six big crashes now this year. He looked like a boxer who just did 12 rounds after his last crash, but he's still smiling, so there's a positive way. It's nice to see him looking positive. Certainly after the Vuelta, he'll have to be resting up pretty quick for a quick turnaround towards the Worlds, but Gerrans knows his stuff. Now, I mentioned earlier that we're going to be talking to my colleague at Fairfax Media, at the Sydney Morning Herald, Daniel Lane. Daniel is not just a sports journalist, he's also an author. He's written a number of fantastic books. He's covered a plethora of sports. He covers the mainstream sports, sure, but he also really gets into some of the lesser known sports or the lesser supported or recognised sports. It doesn't only just make him a great journalist, but it just gives him a real broad insight as to the world of sport and how, it's no secret, we can all get blinkered into the sports that we love best, but it's also great to sort of look outside the box and see what else is there and see what we can learn. I know even just talking to a number of football coaches, Trent Robinson I spoke to, he's the coach of the NRL Roosters, and Michael Checker from the Wallabies, they're always looking outside at other sports to see whether it's a training method, whether it's a management method, or whether it's something to do with using technology or whatever to try and improve the performances of their players and their teams, not just as for athletic performance, but also to keep them grounded, to help mould them as people for when they do finish their careers, they're still on an even keel and ready to forge ahead in their life. Now, so we spoke to Dan, and he caught up with McKilly Jones, the two times former ITU world champion, but not only was she a world champion two times at the Olympic distance, she won the silver medal at the Olympic Games in Sydney in 2000. And don't we remember those games, fabulous times they were. But to show her diversity and also her sheer grit and athletic ability, she also won the 2006 Ironman Triathlon in Kona, Hawaii. Now, Kona's coming up very fast on the agenda, on the calendar now. So, just remember that, folks, she won that race as well. And to all those people out there who are getting ready for Kona, good luck. It's going to be a great experience, whatever you do. I had the privilege to have done the race myself a couple of times, and as hard as it is, as challenging it is, it's such a fantastic experience when you feel that afterglow when you cross the line in Kona. It's just fantastic, and the days after, as you're trying to recover, but your spirits are so high. So no matter how tough it is out there, just keep plodding away. Don't do yourself any harm, but just keep plodding away, because a lot of the win, the personal win for yourself, is actually tackling those challenges and forging ahead and just dealing with the stresses of the day. Because you will be smiling, I promise you, when you get to the end. Anyway, enough of that from me. Let's go and have a listen to what Daniel Lane had to say. And as I said, a very interesting fellow he is, and I certainly would recommend you get out there and read his articles in the Sydney Morning Herald and the Sun Herald and other Fairfax media outlets. Daniel will take me on what a ride. This is your day two. I read your piece on McKilly Jones, one of Australia's greatest sports people, if not certainly triathletes. She's in the US at the moment,
forging her career in coaching and everything, but tell us a little bit about what she was like, because it was 15 years ago, most Australians would have remembered her in the Olympic Games.
Oh, look, I think Makili Jones is one of the real stars of the Sydney Olympics. She didn't get the gold medal that everyone put that pressure on her to win, and she was competing in a home Olympics, and I reckon the weight of expectation must have been incredible. And it's interesting that she won the silver, but she also won the Australian public with the way in which she performed. It was a real fighting race, as I'm sure you would remember, Rick. But she's an outstanding character, outstanding athlete. She's in America. She's helping a triathlete, Katie Kelly, to try and qualify for the Rio Paralympics. And what Makili is doing, she's acting as the partner that helps guide her through the race, because she does have problems with her vision. So she's actually in a position where she may be doing the Olympic course again, which I think is really exciting.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story, because a lot of elite athletes in sports, when they're at the top end of their sports, like what Makili was, they actually find it quite hard to transfer to a coaching role, because they're expected so much excellence from themselves. And yet as a coach, you've got to, you know, you want excellence, but you also have to give some leeway to allow them to sort of find their own way. I mean, how do you think Makili sort of found that sort of transition?
Look, I think, just from talking to her, and it's the first time I've interviewed Makili in about 16, 17 years. So, but from what I do remember of her, she was very generous with her insights and her knowledge. So I think for her, and I think she's also really enthused about helping the Paralympians fulfil their potential and to do great things as well. So, no, she's really into it. They've been having a bit of a training camp over there in California. And, she's really giving them every opportunity. And again, I think that's from that generosity of her spirit and willingness to share her lessons. And she was a world champion. She was everything you could want to be in triathlon. And she's passing on all that good information and allowing for them to learn from her own lessons.
Now, as we're talking now, Dan, the sun is sort of coming, about to set over Sydney Harbour. It's a glorious day, and it just brings back memories of the 2000 Olympics, and talking of Makili's, finish in the triathlon there just in front of the Opera House there. I mean, it really was a fabulous period, wasn't it? But it still seems like yesterday.
It does. Look, Sydney's changing a lot, but there's still those remnants of the Olympics. I mean, you do still see bits of the blue line from where the marathon was run throughout Sydney. And, if you hadn't been to Australia for 15 years and you went out to the Olympic precinct at Homebush, you'd be amazed by how much it's been developed. I mean, it's a thriving community of mixed with residential and business. So it has changed. But look, Sydney benefited so much from the Olympics. The legacy that it, with tourism, just with people being aware of the city, that beautiful course that you just spoke about for the triathlon, I mean, glorious. I don't think there'd be any other city in the world. I reckon you'd struggle in Paris to enjoy doing a triathlon.
You certainly would have to swim in the River Seine there, I can tell you. But not that I've swum there, Dan, but I've seen some bad stuff floating down there, put it that way.
I think you could walk on it.
Now, Dan, obviously in your journalistic career, I mean, you've covered myriad sports, you know, from mainstream sports, from cricket to rugby league, rugby union, and you've also, the other side, you've done, you know, some of the sort of lesser known sports, so to speak, but sports which are trying to struggle to get more recognition. And now we get into this day of where everything seems to be so much professionalism, well, there seems to be so much more professionalism and marketing. Do you think it's getting harder for the lesser known sports to get their fair cut of the pie financially and with recognition, or is it getting easier?
I think they're only constrained by the limitations of the officials. I think we've got a diverse population here in we'll say Sydney, but Australia, we've got a diverse population. I mean, look, there's kids from Somalia who live in the western suburbs of Sydney and other African nations that are perfect for athletics and basketball. And I think it's really up to the officials to get out there and encourage these kids and embrace them and say, we want you to be a part of our sport. You're part of the Australian culture. Come and share the skills that you have for it. And I think once they start doing that, really tapping into the community, and not just African, but all kids, I think then they become more relevant. And I think that's when they can start getting more funding and they can get more sponsors, but it's a matter of being relevant, being proactive, and making people want to come and either compete or support your sport. Because you know, the minor sports, they shine during the Olympics or the Commonwealth Games. I mean, you can represent Australia or Norfolk Island in lawn bowls at the Commonwealth Games. So there's real there's a real attraction for people to get involved with sport.
Now, I know one of the sports you're close to is boxing. You know, Australia's produced some great boxers and some boxers with some colourful characters, but I guess that's the nature of the sport. I know in cycling there's a lot of you know, interesting characters as well, for better and for worse. I mean, you know, they're the sort of sports which intrinsically, throughout the history of those sports, they've been professional. Whether that's been, they've acted professionally is another question. But it's been an interesting, you know, as a journalist, the stories there and the personalities, I've always found really, really interesting. Is that what you feel?
Yeah, I agree. Look, one of my early childhood heroes was Kenrick Tucker. I thought he was a great cyclist and a real powerful competitor, and the way he would explode on the velodrome was really inspiring. But yeah, I think the colourful characters are the most interesting, and often you find the people that they say are mad and crazy are often the most loyal and tremendous people to get to know. I mean, they certainly do keep an eye out for you. But, yeah, that tapestry of all the different characters in boxing is brilliant. You have guys who are white-collar professionals to, you know, garbos or ex-criminals, but they're in there and they all work together, they train together, and it's a great... It's a great environment for people to go and see the real world, and the connections and the friendships and the rivalries that are forged there are legendary. And it's a healthy thing for people to go and do that, because you're under the one roof and they do have the one dream.
Yeah, I've got to put you under the pump here. Is there a fight and a boxer that stands out for you, and a fight and a boxer that you've reported on and followed?
Yeah,
that's your favourite.
Yeah, look, the fight that made an impact on me was Troy Waters when he fought Terry Norris. Terry Norris, at the time, it was the late 1990s. Terry Norris was pound for pound the most powerful boxer in the world. Troy Waters went over there. Everyone thought that he had no hope. I mean, in the opening round, the commentators are saying, after watching Troy cop a volley of punches, the commentators are saying this fight will have to be stopped soon, and they gave him no chance. And what they didn't count on was that Troy was a pretty tough guy, tough upbringing, and he took the fight to Norris and became the first fighter in, I think it was off the top of my head, I think it was 7 years, to knock Norris to the canvas. And that changed the whole perception of this kid from Sydney. They all got behind him, Norris was close to being counted out, but he rallied and beat the count. And unfortunately for Troy, he got his second win with that, and he just exploded. Despite his best efforts, he couldn't put Troy down, but he did split his eyebrow. It needed something like 33 stitches. It was that bad a gash. But Troy didn't want to stop, and which said a lot for his courage. But to me, that fight is always very inspiring, because he had no hope. You know, no one gave him any hope, and yet he proved, you know, there's life in the boxing boots and the gloves, and there's always hope.
And just lastly, Dan, I mean, we've spoken a lot about this, you know, in our times, crossing paths in the office, usually bumping into each other because we're getting a bit old and can't see beyond our nose. But, you know, we've spoken about this year being the centenary of the Anzacs, you know, in Australia, in World War One. I remember the Tour de France this year, one of the early stages was actually dedicated to the Anzacs, you know, we went past a lot of the battlefields in the Somme there and everything like that, and it was really interesting, particularly that night we stayed over. I was staying in a little town where it was just the smallest of towns, and they had a little monument for the soldiers who died, and it overlooks the battlefields. You couldn't help but think of the sacrifices that were made. Get to the point. You've written a lot about this yourself, and you've written some really nice pieces on this, Dan. So, I mean, what's your favourite piece you've written that's really sort of resonated with you, or the subject resonated with you, and the piece resonated with us, the readers?
Yeah, there was Yeah, look, I find that Anzac tradition and the fact that there wasn't only, like, obviously anyone who volunteered to do their duty, very courageous, but because we're sports reporters, you do take an interest in those athletes who went over there and gave everything. There's a couple. It was Ted Larkin, who was the first, former Wallaby, and also the first secretary of the New South Wales Rugby League, who was an outstanding bloke. He was a politician, did very well. He was a Labor politician who won a seat on the North Shore, which was completely Troy Waters versus Terry Norris type stuff. And so he won that election. But when the war broke out, he told Parliament that he couldn't ask other people to do his fighting. So, you know, Ted Larkin, who had kids as well, he left his two children behind, put on a uniform and went overseas, and he got killed on the first day at Gallipoli. He got wounded, and sadly, about 100 yards away from his brother, lay dying as well. So it was it's a really sad story, and it just highlights the waste of it all, because I reckon Ted Larkin could have been a great Prime Minister. And when you read about him, he was also a policeman who'd walked the beat, grew up in Newtown. Had so much to offer, and we're really poor for it. And very interestingly, one of the things that he mooted all those years ago was a game between the Wallabies and the Kangaroos. And that's going to happen in October. Well, not the Wallabies and the Kangaroos, but Western Suburbs Magpies are going to play Randwick in the hybrid game. And so 100 years after his death, his dream of that hybrid game being played is going to come to realisation.
Wow, what a testimony to what, you know, the legacy that he left. And where will that game be played, Dan? Exactly where and when?
It's going to be played in, look, off the top of my head, I think it's October 8th. It's a weekend after the Rugby League Grand Final, and it will be played at Pertec Stadium at Parramatta. So they'll get a big crowd for it. The few games that they have played around the country have been really well supported. People say it's an exciting game. I haven't been to one of these matches yet, but I'm looking forward to having a look, because they say it's entertaining, and I'd like to see a couple of those Rugby League forwards in a line-out.
Well, Dan, how about we go there together, get a good corporate box going, and have a good verbal sparring session together over the rights and wrongs. But thanks very much for being on What a Ride. I know you're busy. You've got a deadline. I've filed already, actually, my story. So the boss is looking over his shoulder now, wondering what the hell we're talking about. Thanks very much for being on What a Ride, and I hope it's not the last time.
Thank you, Rupert. I've really enjoyed being on What a Ride. And you're right, my editor's looking at me and thinking Rupert was the smarter bloke of the two of us today. Thank you, mate. Really appreciate it.
Welcome back to What a Ride, and I'm Rupert Guinness. I'm enjoying this ride. I hope you are. I certainly enjoyed listening to what Dan had to say. I could have sat there for a lot longer and spoken to him, but he had a deadline he had to meet. As we spoke, I'd actually met my deadline. My story was in for the Herald. I guess I was happy and probably more relaxed than he was, but it was a pleasure. It was really nice for him to take time out from his pressured moment in the day. Certainly, as I said, the editor was looking over his shoulder, wondering where Dan was, and he wasn't at his desk, and I'd taken him away. So I got my knuckles wrapped a little bit there, but I hope you thought it was worth it. I thought it was worth it. It was a great chat. I really enjoyed his insights. Now, as I said, Aaron S. Lee is still in the US. He's been everywhere down the south. He's from the south. His next mission is to head to Virginia and then to the town of Richmond, where the UCI World Road Race Championships will be held in the last week of September. Now, we'll hear more from Aaron at the Worlds later on, during the Worlds and after, and I'm sure he's going to have a heap of stories. We're really looking forward to him coming back hearing more about his travels. If you've seen him on Facebook or on Twitter, I'd suggest you follow him. He's got some great anecdotes there, some beautiful pictures as well. So get on board, follow Aaron on Twitter and on Facebook, and you can sort of enjoy the ride with him as he heads further into the States and then comes back. But as I said, one of the things he immersed himself in, besides all his old mates and his haunting grounds where he was born and raised, was the world of BMX. So there you go. He's taken a leap out of the safety box and gone somewhere where he doesn't usually go to. I have to say, I haven't seen a lot of BMX. I've seen it at the Olympic Games, and I've seen how successful it has been and how exciting it is. And I have to admit that even though I've been covering cycling for like 30-odd years, I hadn't really seen enough of BMX. And when I had seen it at the Olympic Games, it was a big learning experience, not just in the action of it all, but also the skills and the strength that's required. And it's probably no coincidence that a number of our road races, not ours, the world's road races, have BMX backgrounds. So there you go. It's a great sport, and it certainly can lead to a diverse career on the bike elsewhere in different disciplines. Now, where Aaron went to, who he caught up with, it was one of their young up-and-coming stars. Well, I guess he would hope to be an up-and-coming star, but he's a very good BMXer anyway. His name is Landon Shake Shively. Sounds more like a boxer. Anyway, he's obviously a very colourful character, and Aaron caught up with Landon just before the recent BMX Eastern Division Finals in Louisville, Kentucky. See, Aaron's getting around. Anyway, Landon won the first round, but he didn't make it past the semi-finals. But it's not a matter about the results, it's a matter about the ride, the journey. And Aaron caught up to have a chat about BMX, what it means to him, and also where he sees the sport going and where he sees himself going in that sport. Let's have a listen.
Aaron Lee here in Minden, Louisiana, and I am joined with one of my high school friends, Barry Shively, and his little man, Landon Shake Shively, who just wrapped up a second place finish at the Louisiana State Champs about 2 weeks ago in New Orleans, and he's about headed this weekend to the Eastern Division Finals in Louisville, Kentucky for the BMX, en route to the National Championships in November. Guys, welcome to What a Ride.
Well, thank you, man. We're excited to be here. It's good to see you.
Absolutely great to see you, bud. And listen, I, Landon, great to see you. I go back to New Orleans in the state championships. Now, you finished second, an impressive result for sure. But from what I understand, you had a bit of a hip injury going into that race.
Yes, sir. The Tuesday before, I was out riding in practice, and I went into a triple wrong and kind of cased and flipped over the handlebars a couple times.
But obviously, it wasn't a bad enough injury for you to do well at state, but it did maybe hinder your performance?
Yeah. Well, it dislocated my hip, so it kind of made me a bit slower in the gate and down the first straight.
And who won that heat, guys?
Gage Brown.
Is he a pretty good mate of yours?
Yes, sir.
Yeah? Now, you riding for a certain team. I've been reading a lot on the social media. It's called Papa Willie?
That's correct.
Now, talk to me. What's Papa Willie?
Well, it's the name actually came from a friend that owns a bicycle shop in Bossier City. And he had wanted to do a skate park years ago, and it just never did come about. And when my son started riding BMX, we went to a few events and decided we wanted to be part of a team, and there wasn't anything local, so we put it together and stole his name, and now we've got about 35 riders, Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas.
Fantastic. And, of course, you and I grew up in little old Minden, Louisiana, which most of the world listening to this right now will have no idea where we're at. Of course, we're about 30 miles east of Shreveport, Louisiana, which, again, most people won't know where that is, so I usually tell people it's about 3 hours west or east of Dallas, and about 6 hours or so north of New Orleans.
Just about.
We're kind of the stepchild of Louisiana up here. But we grew up, there wasn't a lot of bike riding around here. So you got to tell me, Landon, how did you get involved in riding a bike and BMX?
Well, we were down by the lake, and he was talking about having the best cheeseburger from a BMX track, so we were talking a little bit about it, and we started to get where we were thinking about doing it. So we went out to the track and watched a couple races, and then we just decided to do it the next day.
Hey, well, first of all, I got to stop you there. You got to tell me, where's this cheeseburger? Where's that track?
Well, as a kid, I rode a few times traveling with friends at Bayou City BMX in Bossier, or Shreveport at that time. And one of the best burgers I ever ate came off of a grill there, probably just because I was really hungry. But while we were out camping one weekend, I cooked grilled burgers, and they got to talking about it being the best burger they had had in a long time. And somehow or another, it all came back to the BMX track.
Oh, it always comes back to the BMX track. Now, listen, I understand your nickname is Shake. You got to give me a little bit of background on this. Where does this come from?
It comes from because I have a tendency to kind of move my head when I start riding with the bike, and they just start calling me Shake because my helmet would move around with it and be like,
and it's obviously stuck.
Well, yeah, it's stuck on there. It's just that.
No, but the nickname is stuck.
Yeah. The nickname's always been there since I started riding.
Now, you mentioned we talked about the hip injury. You've got a big race coming this weekend. You guys got I'm assuming you're going to drive up to Louisville, Kentucky?
Yeah, we're going to meet up with some other teammates tomorrow and travel with them and go up.
Eastern Division Finals, big race for you guys. What are we expecting, and how's that hip feeling at the moment?
My hips actually healed up right now. And, well, I re-injured myself with my knee. Kind of wrecked at practice again, but it isn't serious. I can ride. But, yeah, the race, it's going to be pretty big. I mean, talking at least 500 motos.
Probably. Oh, wow.
They won't be that
big. So, well, be about two good solid days of racing. Now, you're racing in the 11X category. You're 11 years old. From what I understand, you got a birthday coming up on September 9th.
That's right.
12 years old?
Yes, sir.
Moving up in age group?
Yes, sir.
You excited about it?
Kind of.
Now, anything special going to happen for your birthday? Papa got anything planned for you?
Well, we're kind of just going to have a party.
Oh, fair enough. I like just keeping it low-key, keeping it humble. I noticed your bike over there. Tell me a little bit about your bicycle. What are you riding on? Give me a little bit of a spill on that.
Well, I'm riding a Supercross MV V5. Junior Plus frame with bombshell cranks and bombshell jet hubs.
SLs.
Bombshell SLs. Well, yeah, and some fly handlebars.
Okay. What kind of pedals you running there?
I'm riding Shimano.
Okay.
XTRs.
Okay, so are you running road shoes or mountain bike shoes? Recess, mountain bike, SPDs?
Bike.
Okay. Well, it's a fantastic looking bike, and obviously we're excited to you're representing the local area. Barry, did you ever think that you'd be in the BMX industry like this and be in the sport?
Really didn't. I grew up riding the little bicycles, mostly in town, you know, just on the streets, and then I raced motorcycles a good bit as a child, and he had done motorcycles for a little while, and we had to get out of it, and as we did, and he transferred into the BMX, it just kind of blew up on us with the team. And
I hear you're pretty involved. As a matter of fact, that bicycle store you were talking about earlier said that you're quite a hand on building bicycle wheels as well.
I do a lot for the guys.
Yeah.
I do. I don't work there for a monetary award. I get parts and discounts.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So you guys look like you're having a great time.
We love it. We really do.
Is it something you recommend for other families to get involved in?
Absolutely. You know, big push in the United States right now is to get kids off the couch, out from in front of the TV, off the video games. And Landon is the most dedicated 11-year-old I've ever seen. He practices at least 3 days a week and then races on Saturdays. So Mondays he does fitness training, running stairs, doing lunges, sprints. Tuesdays we're on the track. Friday nights we're on the track. And then races Saturday if we're not going to an event like this weekend.
Fantastic. Landon, obviously it's a great sport. I cover pro cycling, been covering it for years, and obviously that a lot includes BMX, which is, it's found its way into the Olympic Games, of course. Have you thought down the road? Obviously Rio's a bit out of the question, but 2020 Tokyo, not so much so. You'd be just about the right age to compete there. Have you thought about the Olympics or what you'd like to do with the sport, or is that a bit too early right now?
Well, I've been thinking about the Olympics. That's kind of really my dream about BMX, is getting into the Olympics and getting some medal for the USA's. But it's going to be a little while because I got school and all that stuff. So
absolutely. And obviously with your sport and everything, you talked about, your dad talked about your training, which is phenomenal. You're keeping the grades up, obviously, to compete.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's always good to hear. Do you have any heroes in the sport, anyone you're looking up to at the moment?
Connor Fields.
Oh, absolutely. Have you had a chance to meet Connor?
No, sir, but I've been to a couple races where he was at.
Well, what do you like most about Connor's style of riding?
Well, he just inspires me to get up every day and start getting on my bike.
Fantastic. Would you like to do anything after BMX? Have you thought about moving to the mountain bike or perhaps the track, the velodrome, or even the road?
Really, if I ever stop racing, I'll probably go back to dirt bikes.
Okay, so you're big in the motocross, the actual motorbikes then?
Yes, sir.
Oh, fantastic. Well, listen, I want to say thank you for stopping by today. Good luck. Congratulations on the state champs. And then good luck this weekend up in Kentucky. Give us a call when you get in and let us know how you go.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much, Landon. It's great to meet you. Barry, great to see you, old friend.
Man, I appreciate it.
Thanks
bud. Thanks for the time.
Cheers.
Couldn't pass the test.
Welcome back to What a Ride. I'm Rupert Guinness, travelling solo, but enjoying the ride. We were just listening to Aaron S. Lee, my usual partner in crime on What a Ride, brought to you by Australian Broadcasting Media. He was doing an interview with Landon Shake Shively, a young BMX rider in the US. Anyway, I really enjoyed that view and that interview, and you know, the world of sport is such a small place, really, isn't it? The world's big, but the world of sport is so small, and it's great to be able to hear all these different stories from so many various areas of cycling, but triathlon and other sports as well. Anyway, so Aaron, we'll be looking forward to him coming back. Now, as I said earlier in the show, another person we caught up with is Phil Anderson. Phil Anderson, if you don't know, he was the first non-European to ever wear the yellow jersey, the leader's jersey of the Tour de France in the early 1980s. And he was obviously the first Australian, and he went on to compete in the Tour 13 times, of which he finished in the top 10 five times and was twice fifth overall. Now, when we caught up with Phil, we didn't speak to him about racing. If you caught our last episode, episode 7, we had a good chat to him about the Tour de France and the fallout there, and also where he felt the sport was heading to and how Australia's place was fitting into the spectrum of international cycling. And we had a little look, you know, obviously about the Vuelta a España and the World Championships to come. But for this episode, we're going to take a turn here. We're going to turn right, and we're going to go down the path of cyclotourism. Now, Phil Anderson does have his own cycling tours company, Phil Anderson Tours, and he's had it going for a number of years now, and it's not just about taking tours to the Tour de France. He goes to other races as well, and even next year he's taking a river cruise in Europe, which in this upcoming interview he speaks about. But when we have a chat, we don't just talk about his tours. We talk about the industry generally, and how different tours are tailored for different interests and needs and desires and abilities, obviously, and obviously tastes as well in wine and food, etc. So, you know, Phil was, you know, gave some great insights there. So let's have a listen to see what Phil has to say about this industry. And I can highly recommend, if you want to get on board, he'll tell you his details, how to make contact. And if you want to be on board with any other touring companies, just get onto Google and do a search for cycling tours. Australia has a large number of them, and as I said, they're tailor-made to suit any interest that you have, or most interests, within reason anyway. Anyway, let's catch up with Phil and hear what he has to say about it all.
Well, welcome back to What a Ride. I'm Rupert Guinness, and with me again on the show is Australia's first ever yellow jersey wearer in the Tour de France. He finished in the top 10 five times from 13 participations. I don't have to give any more clues or anything about who this guy is. His name is Phil Anderson. But one thing about Phil that a lot of people may not know is that he also has his own company going since he's retired, called Phil Anderson Cycling. He started it in 1998, and I guess if anyone has seen Phil knows that he's probably just as lean, not mean, but lean as he was when he was a cyclist, as a racing cyclist. But I guess you have to be to take these touring groups around, which is what he does. Phil, welcome back to What a Ride, and also just tell us a bit about what got you into the industry of cycling tourism.
Oh, Rupert, yes, well, I think it was in 97, the year prior, I was over at in France as working for Nike, the apparel company, and they were just starting to get into cycle sport, and they were the official yellow jersey provider. You know, all the different jerseys had the swoosh on there, and so I was over there hosting some special guests of theirs with pissed flying. From around the world, and we'd give them hospitality. Most of them were from America, so didn't understand the sport. They were just getting into it, as I said, and so I was there holding their hand through some of the different aspects of the tour. And we hosted those guests. You know, it was a four or five star hospitality packages we gave them. And
it was wonderful, and those guests went away having had a fantastic experience. And looking around after that, I thought that there was nothing else out there on the market like that. There was a few companies out there, but they were more sort of driven for the, not the backpacker market, but the sort of 2-3 star. There was nothing really of great quality accommodations and packages together. So I thought there was space to get into something like what we offered Nike, but more for the general consumer. So I started doing tours, and in those early days, 98 was my first tour, and it was like a 2.5 week package, so it was very long, and we were chasing the race every day. There was some of our guests brought bikes, but there was barely time to ride the bike because we were just so busy chasing the race. I think we were following you around, Rick. We were pretty close, but you can imagine what your program's like when you're over there with your journalist hat on, trying to fit time to ride. It was very difficult. So things have morphed quite a bit to what we deliver today.
Yeah, I was just saying to someone the other day about how the tour has changed from my perspective, and how there was a time where you used to be able to sort of drive along on the course and just follow the breakaway, toot and go past the peloton, find a nice little place to have a bit of lunch, see the break go past and think we better ask for the bill and then rejoin the race. It was a pleasant afternoon, but now everything's become so hectic and so big. And I, from your point of view as well, I guess you've seen that as well. It's just so busy. You almost have to have a military style strategy for each day, don't you, Phil?
Yeah, well, you have to have a reasonably tight running seat, and we try and dovetail with certain elements of the event rather than chase it every day. Like, we used to see the race sometimes 3-4 times a day, and it was just exhausting. So now we usually see it every day. Sometimes we miss a day, we might go ahead. But still staying in excellent properties, usually 2 or 3 nights in each property. And one day we'll ride to the top of the mountain, just wait for the event to come up and pass us or the finish. But it's not all about being at the start or the finish. In fact, those particular elements of the race, while it's critical for the results, sometimes the best experiences you have are out in the middle of nowhere, in a small little village where there's not too many people, but you sit down, have a meal, and you listen to the locals, and they tell you about the last time the tour came through this place. It was some time after the war, and they're so excited and proud that the event would even come to their corner of France. And eventually you'll go outside and the race, or you can feel the race coming, the energy sort of building, and eventually you'll see the helicopters coming over the hill and it comes by. It's not just about a 10-second package. It's about the build up, the emotions, the crowd, the other people there. It's become a global event, and you can be in a very isolated place in the middle of nowhere, and there'll be people from all around the world there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how it's very much become cycling tourism has become a boom business in many ways, around not just the Tour de France but other bike races. And I know that there are other companies that are out there as well, but I guess there's a number of companies, as you said, that cater for different markets. There will be some who are sort of the backpacker style ones. There'll be some who want to do every stage, and there's others who want to, say, like with yours, go to the 4 or 5 star places, stop and take a breather and enjoy the environment and the people and the food and the wine around them.
Every company has a point of difference, I think. From one tour to another, we visit tours, different events and different ends of the tour. We might have a tour in the Pyrenees where we might be riding more, like we did this year, and we'll actually wait for the race to come. So we were there for 5 or 6 days before the race even arrived in the south of France. The race, when we started, was up in Normandy, and we were
you know, we arrived in Barcelona, so we were down in Spain and doing all the climbs in the Pyrenees, and eventually the race arrived. So the race like that, where we only had like three or four interfaces with the tour when it finally arrived down there, to, and you know, a week later we had another tour in the Alps, and you know, and that way, and then you know, we were seeing the race on most days, you know, critical points in the event, and you know, we were there screaming for Richie and his supporting Froome on the Alptuers. It was just a, it was just like a huge party up there on Alptuers this year. So yeah, each tour is different than the next, and you know, different providers offer different elements. And I guess, you know, for the guests or for the clients, it's, you know, they should ask questions and find out exactly what they're going to be getting, and if that suits what they're looking for.
I guess I've got to ask you the simplest question, Phil, is when you see the race go past, do you miss the race? Do you miss not being in the peloton and the challenge of the tour and the competitors? Is that still in you?
Look, when you see the Tour de France, whether it's on television or you're beside the road, you're seeing, you know, the end result after a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and you're seeing it, the end product, and it's you know, it's all very well rehearsed, and, you know, everybody's fit, and normally it's great weather, and you know, it's the pinnacle of the season, but behind that there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and a lot of effort that's got into getting to that to that point, and politics as well, you know, within the team or you know, the team getting selected. And so, you know, there's some things I do miss. You know, the camaraderie, the feeling of success, you know, when you're in a winning team or somebody wins a stage from one of your mates. You know, there's some elements you do miss, but I certainly don't miss all the hard work and training and preparation that goes into it.
I guess in many ways, though, with the groups that you have, whether it's at a stage race or a Tour de France or a Grand Tour or even the Classics, wherever you go, the group you have still has to have the same dynamism where it can get on together. You know, you've got different personalities and you've got different riding abilities. How do you sort of manage all that, Phil, particularly with you being the, I guess, the team leader, per se, or the group leader?
Yeah, well, you're right, Rook. I think the success of the group really comes down to how the synergy of the guests and how they all get on, and you know, you never really know until you get on the ground. And you know, we cater for people who don't ride. We cater for people who do ride, people from, you know, everywhere in between. So we split the different groups, and we know we have a long, faster group and a slower, shorter ride group, and then you have people that don't ride at all. So, yeah, we try and cater to what everybody wants. Some days we'll all go out together, and then we'll stop for coffee, and then we'll split because, you know, some want to go and hammer up a hill, and other times, you know, they just want to take it easy and wait at the bottom of the mountain and wait for the race to come through instead of waiting on the top. So, yeah, you just got to listen to what the guests want, and, you know, because we deal with small groups, it's a lot easier than having, you know, 40 or 50 people in a big coach. It's difficult to split and dice. So, yeah, we just, listen to what people have what they're looking for.
I'm speaking with Phil Anderson, the former cyclist, Australian cyclist, and the owner of Phil Anderson Cycling, and who conducts a whole lot of tours, and they sound like great fun and a great excitement. Phil, I guess, you know, it is a success story in many ways, but I guess not everything can go right on a tour. Have you got to give us a little bit of an insight? What can go wrong? Perhaps what has gone wrong? Have you lost anybody on one of your tours?
Well, it's a lot easier now with the technology of, you know, everybody's got mobiles. Mapping now with GPS makes it a lot easier. You know, in the years gone by, we'd have to print out little maps and give everybody maps. And you know, as a group leader, you'd be stopping every 10 or 15 minutes to look at the map, because it's not like here where you've got sort of one row between A and B. Over there, you've got a whole network of, like, thousands of roads, and we always try and find the smallest possible road, which is of a bitumen surface, simply because they're most pleasant to ride on off the beaten track.
So yeah, it was very difficult navigating in those days, but now with GPS, it's a lot easier. But yeah, things that can go wrong, you can have an accident, somebody can fall off, but fortunately, we usually have vehicles right there, so we can attend to the bike, or somebody's got a graze, attend to first aid directly. But I think we sometimes you can have issues with roofs, but where people have a domestic, and suddenly you've got a situation where you've got to get an extra room, things like that, which are really out of our hands. But we try and solve problems on the ground. But I have a good staff that I draw on, and if it's beyond my abilities, usually I'll lean on one of my teammates to come in and assist.
So you provide relationship counsel. You're like the real Dr. Phil.
There you are, exactly.
Hey, Phil, obviously, like a lot of your tours aren't just about going to Europe. I know you do have a lot in Australia as well. But I understand next year you're going to have a tour with a certain difference, a cruise. Is that right?
Yeah, river cruise. It starts in Budapest and goes up the Danube and ends up in Amsterdam, actually. So it's a river cruise, which I think it's like 1,800 kilometres along the river. And so you climb on the boat, I think it's mid-June, and you unpack your things in your cabin, and which is different than my usual tours, where you're changing every couple of days. So you're sleeping on the boat, you're riding a little bit during the day. Not long ride, possibly 60, 80 kilometres, and not even every day, because you want to enjoy the elements of the cruise, which they always offer, which is daily sort of trips to the different castles. You always see those mystical structures up on the sides of the river. So yeah, there's monasteries and breweries, which I'm always interested in going for the tasting. There's lots of things on offer on the cruise, and of course it's good for couples, because while not everybody wants to ride, it's sometimes difficult to get that lead pass. Something like this, there's plenty to offer for everybody.
Okay, and and for your tours, where can people go to find your tours, Phil?
Geez, this is a real infomercial, isn't it? Look, Phil Anderson Cycling gets you on our webpage, and our tours, to the Giro or to the next year, I think we're going to the Vuelta, and of course the river cruise. It's all lead you that way.
Okay. Now the other thing I've got to ask you, I've heard about this show called the Gruppetto Show. Tell us a bit about the Gruppetto Show, and where can people see it now? What's it about? I mean, someone was telling me that it's a little bit more lighthearted.
Yes, look, it's a comical look on cycling. There's not too much seriousness to it. It's very light. It's really meant to give a good laugh. Like, there's quite a few different streams of cycling media out there now, and this is meant to be something which is a bit more like one of those footy shows, or where we look at certain aspects. It might be commuting, like we just had someone of the cyclocross championships down here in Melbourne, which is kind of the latest rage for cycling at the moment. It's just something we've Channel 31, which is a network down here in Victoria, and it can be got online as well. In fact, we've already got three out there, so it's just the Gruppetto Show. If you look at that, if you just Google that or go to YouTube, you'll get the feel of it. But it's something I really enjoy doing, and it's I think it's a space which there's room for,
And so, yeah, very excited about it.
And I see you've got an interesting co-host in former track world champion team pursuer, Billy Joe Shearsby.
Yes, yes, from the 93 World Championships. That's right. So, yeah, he's a comic in himself. I think he should be in stand-up. In fact, I think he has done some stand-up. And there's lots of hidden talent there, and he can even play the ukulele, which is surprising, really.
Gee, maybe. There's a lot of jokes we could say about that, Phil, but unfortunately we haven't got time. But if you can just say, like, where we can get it, where the show is, Gruppetto. How do you, can you spell it, gruppetto.com?
Yeah, it's just Gruppetto, so that's G-R-O. Gruppetto show. Gruppetto show. So okay. Yeah, if you just Google that or YouTube it, and yeah, it should come up. We've got three up at the moment, and they'll continue to roll out. We're doing live recording in Geelong in a bar that's coming up on Thursday. So, you know, usually takes us a week or so to cut it up and put it out there. But yeah, we're looking forward to continuing.
Oh, well, that's great, Phil. Well, look, sounds like you're really enjoying cycling in the post-race career. It's great to hear you really getting involved, and hear a lot of tales from people who've been on your tours. They love them, and it's great that you got into the Gruppetto show now, where you can actually have a laugh. And I think everything gets so serious these days. It's great to be able to have a laugh and occasionally laugh at yourself.
Well, thanks, Rube. I'm looking forward to following your exploits as well. I really enjoyed the little vignettes you did from the Tour de France. They were great, and I look forward to the show as well.
Okay, Phil. Well, you take care, mate. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Rube.
You're listening to What a Ride with Aaron S. Lee and Rupert Guinness. I'm Rupert Guinness, driving the bus solo this episode. We've been hearing from Aaron, obviously, in the show. He's calling in from the United States. He'll be back on the show soon. Just then, we'll just listen to Phil Anderson talking about cyclotourism, or cycling touring, whatever way you want to call it. But it's about having a holiday with bikes, going to not just races, but also to see countries and experience different cultures. You know, it just goes to show how good cycling really is. It's not just about racing and competition. You know, you really can enjoy it. And you can get to see areas of the world that you don't necessarily get to see in a car. And certainly if you are in the same areas of cars, you're going a bit slower, and you can obviously see a lot more and take it all in. Anyway, it's a good note to sort of get towards the end of our show for this week, because as in Australia, we're heading towards, we've started spring and we're heading towards summer, and you get that feel for what you're going to do for holidays. And I guess if you're in the Northern Hemisphere in Europe and the United States, as winter is closing in, you may be thinking about what you're going to do next spring and planning your holidays as well. It's certainly been a great, I've enjoyed this episode of What a Ride. I've got to say, though, it's really looking forward to the weeks to come. You know, sport never ceases to stop, and it never seems to slow down at all. Just as you think you're getting to the end of one season, you're starting another in another sport, and quite often there's several seasons all at once with several sports together. I'm really looking forward to the Rugby World Cup. The Wallabies are going to be opening their World Cup campaign against Fiji in Cardiff on September 23. The World Cup actually begins in England on September 18 on a Friday, when England play Fiji. So the Fijians are going to already have a game up their sleeve before they take on the Wallabies, but it'll be interesting to see how they've come out of that first game against England. England, Australia, Fiji, Wales and Uruguay make up what they call the Pool of Death. It's the most hotly contested of the four pools in the World Cup. We've got only two spots for the quarterfinals. In that pool, including Wales, there's three top-tier nations, with Wales, England and Australia. So one of those countries will miss out, but you never know, possibly two, because the Fijians, two times quarterfinalists, could produce a surprise and force another one of those top-tier nations out. You just never know. World Cup rugby is a certainly different beast than natural, normal test rugby. To win the World Cup, you've got to win seven games back-to-back, and that's a fairly hefty toll on any squad. squads of 31 players each, but rest assured, every one of those 31 are used in some form or fashion. They have to, you know, switch teams around to, you know, meet up with the program that's ahead of them, and also to cover for injuries that are inevitable in a contact sport like that. Also, I've got to say, I wish Jared Hayne all the best over in the United States as he continues his remarkable story and his, in his case, a remarkable career, a new career that's just embarked, that he's just embarked on as the coach of the San Francisco 49ers was quick to remind him of when he told him, or when he gave him the news that he was on the 53-man roster. It's interesting to note that you're not always on that roster once you're named on it either, because the coach can chop and change a few players as the season unravels week by week. So for Jared Hayne, and he knows it better than anyone, the challenge is still just as big as it was when he left Australia. But he's the sort of seems to have the right mentality. I don't know him very well. I know that the journalists have been over there. You know, Michael Chambers from Fairfax Media, he's been following the story day in, day out. So maybe we can get a call in with Michael for the next episode. It'd be good to see how he feels about it now that now the season will be up and going by the time our next episode is up and going. Anyway, if you're out there, if you're in Sydney or if you're in Australia gearing up for spring, we wish you all the very best as you get out there. Just get out off the sofa, enjoy what the world has to offer out there, not always just indoors. Speaking of which, I'm indoors right now, so I think I might just get outdoors on this beautiful, sunny Sydney spring day. In the meantime, all the very best. Stay safe. I hope you really enjoyed this episode of What a Ride. Thanks very much for all your feedback. If you have any news or views or any requests, just let us know. You can follow us on iTunes, on Facebook, and we put all the links out there anyway. Myself and Aaron S. Lee, you can contact us through social media. I'm on Facebook and Twitter, so our doors are open. Thanks again, and stay safe, and enjoy the ride. What a ride it is.
shake. I must have been asleep for days. Your moving lips to breathe her name. I opened up my eyes and found myself alone, alone, alone above a raging sea. Stole the only girl I loved, drowned her deep inside of me. You knew, soft and lonely. You knew, lost and lonely. You knew, just like heaven.